Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Cigars, cigarettes, Eddie Valiant.
Betty?
Long time no see.
What are you doing here?
Work's been kind of slow since cartoons went to color. But I still got it, Eddie. Boop, boop, be-doop.
Before television came along, animated cartoons were a lot different. They played before movies and were often little hand grenades of social and political satire designed to appeal to adults. That's how Reed Mittenbuehler describes them. He knows all about early animation. Reed's the author of Wild Minds, the artists and rivalries that inspired the golden age of animation. The history begins with the newspaper cartoonist Winsor McCay. He was one of the first animators, but his influence was pretty much forgotten by 1934 when he passed away. McCay believed that animation could replace the paintings people went to see in museums. He released his third cartoon in 1914, and it was a game changer.
So Gertie the Dinosaur is this watershed moment in the history of animation. And here you have this character, it's a dinosaur, but it had personality. Like, he's brought personality to these moving images. The way it breathes, it seems to have a sense of humor. It's graceful. It's very lifelike. And he had a vaudeville show where he would travel around, you know, playing this, and he'd be alongside of it, sometimes doing tricks like feeding Gertie, you know, throwing apples up at the screen. The apple would go behind the screen and that kind of thing. And that first generation of animators, including people like Walt Disney and the Fleischer brothers, they saw Gertie, and almost every single one of them later in life cited it as a major influence.
Mm-hmm. It was around the same time that a guy named Max Fleischer invented the rotoscope. What was the rotoscope and what did it do?
So the rotoscope is this device. A lot of these early cartoons, they flickered on the screen. They had kind of, you know, weird movements. And Max Fleischer, he was a little bit of everything. He was an engineer. He was an artist, an inventor. And he came up with this device that you could film an image moving, and then an animator could trace it. It would project it onto a screen, and the animator could trace over it so that you could make your drawings that way, so that they were very lifelike. But the thing about the rotoscope is that a lot of animators later on didn't like it, because animation at its best offers this opportunity to go into a kind of fantasy realm, you know, where you can draw talking animals and things like that, and they can do all these crazy things that you can't really do on Earth, you know, you defy gravity and that sort of thing. And the rotoscope is always very realistic. You see it used a little bit in later movies. They use it a little bit in Snow White, for instance, when they were animating humans, but a lot of animators actually shied away from it, because they're like, well, the advantage we have with this art form is not being realistic, it's being fantastic and surreal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's fast forward to 1928, when there is this seismic shift when sound comes to motion pictures and also to animated cartoons. Max Fleischer and his younger brother Dave are running their own studio. 5 years later, their first Popeye the Sailor cartoon makes its debut.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, cause I eat me spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
And by 1935, Popeye is even more popular than Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse. How did that happen?
With the advent of sound, what's so great about this story is that it really saved cartoons. Cartoons were seen by a lot of people as a novelty. And near the end of the 20s, you had Felix the Cat, who is this huge character. He's iconic. People all over the world recognize him. But a lot of people, when cartoons would flicker up on the screen, would kind of groan, like, oh, not another one of these. It was, you know. And some people, a lot of cartoon studios had shut down by this point. But with the advent of sound, a lot of movie studios owned music catalogs, you know, popular music, and they were looking for a way to promote these songs. And animation offered them a way to do that. Animators had a lot of freedom to kind of do whatever they wanted with the images, just as long as they got a couple of those songs in their cartoons, you know, to create ancillary income for the studios. So, you know, it really breathed life into the form.
As we all know, Popeye was strong to the finish because he eats a spinach. He usually ate his spinach by squeezing a can of it in his fist and squirting a clump of it into the air and catching it in his mouth, but sometimes he sucked the spinach through his pipe. Why?
This is a funny story because none of the Fleischer animators ever admitted directly to using that as a stand-in for, you know, marijuana. But you see over time, especially as those cartoons shifted ownership, you start seeing this idea that it is marijuana coming into play. So by the time you get to the 1950s, which at that point, Fleischer, the studio wasn't run by the Fleischers anymore, you see these references to, you know, pure Bolivian spinach, you know, and that kind of stuff. But at the time, spinach was also used as a kind of nickname sometimes for marijuana. I wanted to explore that in the book a little bit because it's an interesting parallel, but it also illustrates, you know, the people making these cartoons, a lot of times they were hanging out in jazz clubs. They were making something that was very much for adults. And when interviewed later, we're adamant about that. Like, we made these cartoons for us. We made them for adults. We didn't really make them for children. If children happened to be entertained by them, that was great.
Of course, we can't talk about animation without talking about Walt Disney. He made the first animated feature-length film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It premiered in 1937. How did audiences and critics respond to it?
Everyone responded very enthusiastically. You know, when you go back and you look at the criticism of the day, a lot of very high-minded magazines, you know, the Literati came out. They didn't see it really as a kid's movie. It was a family movie in a way, for sure. I mean, it had to appeal to a broad audience just because it was so expensive to make. You had to be able to draw in that broad audience. But people just gushed over it as a masterpiece. Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's home from work we go. There's a great story in the book, though, that, you know, in the UK, children weren't actually allowed to see it without an accompanying parent. And later on, Dr. Spock had made the joke that apparently at Radio City Music Hall, there was this rumor that, you know, they had to change the upholstery on a bunch of seats because a lot of children had wet them while watching the film. It was the most lucrative film at the time when it came out.
Mm-hmm. In 1943, Warner Brothers released a spoof of Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was destined to become one of the most controversial cartoons in history. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so the title of that film is Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs, and it was a black parody of Snow White.
Well, once there was a mean old queen, and she lived in a gorgeous castle.
And that's the story I really wanted to get into. It's very hard to find that cartoon now. Warner Brothers doesn't release it. It doesn't really pass muster by today's sensibilities at all. But the story behind it is really interesting, and it kind of illustrates how it's important to always remember context and nuance when we look at these stories. Bob Clampett, who is a famous Warner Brothers director, he's a big jazz fan. And one day he was out at Duke Ellington's Review. He's watching Duke Ellington in concert. And after the show, he's behind stage. He's talking to the musicians. And he was asked, you know, why don't you make cartoons about us? And his answer was, you know, I don't really have a good reason for that. So he collaborates with a lot of these musicians. So Louis Armstrong had wanted to do one of the voices. He couldn't because he was away on tour. But he brings in all of these musicians, they helped out with the music and everything. And when you look at the movie, I mean, it doesn't play well, you know, by today's standards, but the music is really good. And at the time, it got a mixed reaction when it came out. A lot of African Americans really liked it. You know, they're like, you know, this is celebrating jazz. It's celebrating this part of our heritage, you know. And it also, it was less that those rural stereotypes. A lot of people were starting to move to cities and it looked at that. And so they appreciated that about it. Others didn't appreciate that about it. One of the biggest critics of it was actually the United States government. It promotes stereotypes. So it was a very controversial film, even in its own time. And today it's extremely controversial.
It's worth pointing out that for authenticity, Clampett made sure he included black musicians, jazz musicians, to help with the soundtrack. But he also invited black artists, writers to help write the story and create gags, didn't he?
Right. He brought them in for that authenticity and he wanted to include them. Unfortunately, they weren't credited. The studio, Leon Schlesinger, was cheap and he already had staff, you know, that was doing that kind of stuff in music. So they still contributed because he really wanted to capture the energy of jazz, this music that he loved. And he wanted to work with them to do that. Unfortunately, they didn't get the credit that they deserved.
Yeah. Let's get back to Walt Disney for a minute or so. Disney released Fantasia in 1940. This was a really ambitious project, which found Walt collaborating with conductor Leopold Stokowski. Many of the artists at Disney were not happy about this idea. Why?
Well, some were and some weren't. So this is an interesting collaboration because you've got Leopold Stokowski, and he's the most popular orchestra conductor in the country at the time, Philadelphia Orchestra. One of his goals is he wanted to take this high art classical music and kind of bring it down to the masses. And at the same time, you've got Walt Disney, who's known for having an art that appeals to the masses, and he's raising it up kind of as a high art. And so it's a perfect kind of collaboration that way we'll take and we'll put images to all of these songs, and we'll find a way to make it click for a lot of people. But Leopold Stokowski could be a little bit pretentious, and a lot of the animators didn't always appreciate his presence in the studio. There's a great story where one day the beverage cart comes by while they're working. Like, they would sit in this room, the Disney studio, and they're listening to records and they're talking about it and they're coming up with ideas for what images can go with the music. And there's a Coca-Cola on the beverage cart, and Stokowski didn't seem to know what it was. Like, well, what's this? And Walt Disney's explaining to him, well, you know, it's Coca-Cola. And Stokowski's drinking it like a fine wine. He's like, good, you know, quite good. And all the animators, these are gag men, are sitting around like, oh, give me a break. And so when they go to make the movie, Walt Disney solicited the animators for possible titles before they decided on Fantasia. And one of them was Hybrowski by Stokowski.
Mm-hmm. Disney told his staff that he wanted Fantasia to change the history of motion pictures. Do you think it did?
For animation, it really did, in a way, and people could debate this, do what Winsor McKay had wanted to. You know, Winsor McKay really wanted to raise animation to a high art form. And Fantasia occupies its own space. It's a sensual, it's very emotional. It doesn't have a story. It's a sensory experience. I think it probably opened up a lot of artists' eyes to what was possible. And technically, just visually, the film is stunning.
One of the most compelling storylines in your book is the rivalry between Walt Disney and Max Fleischer. How did that play out?
Well, for Max Fleischer, it didn't play out particularly well. I was really drawn to this because Max Fleischer, in a lot of ways, you know, he's the number two. It's kind of like Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan. Scottie Pippen's arguably the second best player in the NBA when he's playing. Unfortunately, he has to play in the shadow of not only the best player in the league, but arguably maybe the best player of all time. You know, Max Fleischer, the best work of the Fleischer Studios rivaled the best work of the Disney Studios. And Fleischer's name today, it's not a household name. I mean, it's barely remembered. And Fleischer lost his studio in the early 40s, and he died pretty poor. And yet, those brothers were the force behind just these icons, Betty Boop, Popeye.
Yeah, what do you think is Max Fleischer's greatest achievement? Can you point to one cartoon?
Bimbo's Initiation, I think, is... I mean, there's several. I mean, it's hard to pick just one. But that's a cartoon that, if you go and you look at it, there are these themes just underneath the current of that film about assimilation. The Fleischers were Jewish. Max Fleischer was born in Europe and come over to the United States. And they examine a lot of this themes, even in the title, Initiation.
By the mystic order of the... Wanna be a member? Wanna be a member?
No.
And Bimbo, the main character, he's lured into this underground lair. It's never quite clear what it is. And you've got all these different types of music playing. Some of the music is clarinet music you might hear, you know, in a place like Minsk, you know, it's old world. But then you also hear Turkey in the Straw, which is like a very American. It's part of Americana. And so they're going back and forth with these different influences in that cartoon. And then at the end, you know, he's asked by what appears to be a cult, you know, want to be a member, want to be a member, want to be a member. And then it ends in this sexual sequence with he and Betty Boop basically kind of spanking each other. So it's a very weird, surreal film, but there's a lot in it to unpack and pull apart and analyze just about the American experience and about America, you know, when they made this cartoon. It's still part of the old weird experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Reed Mintenbueller, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Reed Mintenbueller is the author of Wild Minds, the artists and rivalries that inspired the golden age of animation. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Mary Lynn Ricecup, Cliff Nestroth, and Reed Mintenbueller. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He's being weird. I have no idea why he's being weird and dressed in that suit.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Nope, Adam's completely anal about that kind of stuff.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
You don't need to use your last name. You've been here over a month. What is it?
Look out, look out. Big elephants on parade. Here they come. They're pretty happening. They're here, they're there. Big elephants everywhere.